Welcome to the near post-local, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. I'm Peter Funnell. There are three things happening of significance on our football and futsal scene here in the ACT. The first of those is that the local futsal competition will resume in the second week of February, when school holidays finish and students are back at school. The second, of course, is that our Premier League clubs are in their pre-season mode, furiously trying to identify players and settle player rosters across four teams: Premier League Pathways, Premier League 18s and Premier League 16s. This is a serious piece of work for the Premier League clubs, as the fate of their season hangs upon it. And the final thing is an absolutely sensational event being conducted all of this week and concluding on Saturday. It's the second annual FFA State Institute Challenge. There are nine teams from the state institutes and training centres from around Australia. It's an intense period of football, and it's intended to promote the new national curriculum. Well, more than that. I'll quote from Han Berger, the FFA technical director, and I quote, "As we outlined in the national football curriculum, what we are looking for now is a certain type of player that has good technical skill and understands the principles and guidelines of the new national football curriculum." He goes on, "This year we will be trialling a number of innovations for the State Institute Challenge to assess how the various teams have adopted the new national football curriculum that we began implementing last year." End of quote. Well, that reads to me like the FFA are now putting the microscope over the institutes and in particular the coaches. Harnberger goes on, "It must be understood that this event is a development tournament, and although the results count, the way teams play is more important than the final score. To this end, teams can collect bonus points for the quality of their technical performance, as judged by the FFA Technical Committee." End of quote. Well, again, what a refreshing change. So we're firmly in develop and not in win. Again, this will shine the light on the coaches, and we'll see just how well these institutes and their coaches are doing their jobs. Interestingly enough, Harnberger goes on to say, quote, "If these innovations are successful, we will be looking to use them at this year's FFA National Youth Championships for boys and girls." End of quote. Well, I sincerely hope they do. The argument of win or develop must be won by develop. Like anything else, the things that get measured and taken seriously are the ones the coaches and the institutes will attend to. Now, there's one other thing I'd like to say about this State Institute Challenge. If you can't get out and see the games at the AIS during the week, there is one game that will be worth getting out to, and that's on Saturday. The team that wins, in terms of the accumulated points, the team will be called the Challenge Winner, will play another team called the All-Stars. And the All-Star team will be selected by the coaches, who at the end of every game nominate a defender, midfielder and attacker from their opposition team. And this will then be considered by the FFA Technical Committee and a team formed called the All-Stars. The last game will be the best team that played in the best style against all of the other best players as judged by the other coaches. Should be interesting. Not a game to be missed. Starts at 2 p.m. at the AIS on Saturday. Be there. Oh yeah, how's it going so far? Well, early days, but quite a few games played. I'd have to say South Australia and Western Australia are looking like the teams who most understand the new national curriculum. But we'll see how that rolls out in the next couple of days. In the meantime, we have an extended interview with Paul Penner. He's a sports psychologist, and he was the sports psychologist with the Australian Olympic swim team at the Beijing Olympics. He deals with a lot of elite athletes, both in football, swimming and other disciplines, and indeed in the performing arts. He has some interesting observations about the use of sports psychologists. But before we start with Paul Penner, let's have a listen to the Australian Sports Commission's view on the aspect of psychology in relation to sport.
Sport psychology is the application of psychological principles to the sport environment. By developing athletes' psychological skills and their mental health, they can better manage the sport environment, better manage their emotions, and get a lot more out of the sport experiences. Goal setting is a set of skills required to identify specific long and short-term targets and evaluate progress within a specific time frame. Regularly setting and evaluating performance goals can help athletes to focus, stay motivated, and feel more in control. Effective goals are those that are written down, specific, include long, short-term and training goals, include observable or measurable elements such as times, reps or percentages, challenging but realistic, and reviewed. Evaluating goals is a really important part of goal setting. It provides athletes to feel a sense of achievement and confidence. It also provides athletes with an opportunity to analyse their performance and identify areas to be refined in the future.
Reviewing my goals helps me by letting me see if I've achieved them, and if not, looking at what I have to change.
During pressure situations, an athlete's ability to manage their own emotions is really put to the test. In tight situations, athletes can experience high levels of nerves or even anxiety or panic. These negative emotions can be experienced physically through sweaty palms or increased heart rate, but also mentally through racing thoughts and an inability to focus on the task. Obviously, these effects can be detrimental to performance. Emotions, or the way we feel, is largely dependent upon how we interpret situations. In a situation where an athlete is feeling anxious or panicked, typically their thinking is irrational and focused on something catastrophic occurring in the future. If an athlete is extremely upset or disappointed with poor performances, and this feeling continues for an extended period, typically they're exaggerating the significance of the performance. An effective method to manage negative emotions such as anxiety or enduring disappointment is to identify what athletes are telling themselves during times of stress. Athletes need to make sure that their thinking is grounded in reality and represents the big picture. Coaches can assist athletes to manage their emotions by discussing their self-talk, reinforcing successful past performances, promoting realistic thinking, avoiding irrational thinking when stressed, helping athletes develop a pre-performance routine to gain control over their emotional state. In wrapping up, I just want to reinforce, no matter what level of sport you're coaching, these strategies work. Ask yourself these questions. What are some examples of goals that athletes in your sport might set? These might be outcome, performance, or process goals. How could you assist an athlete who is struggling to cope with disappointment?
We're talking to Paul Penner, sports psychologist and a principal in the firm Focus Performance Psychology. Paul operates with individuals and teams in sport and the performing art. Now, Paul is a sports psychologist for the Australian swim team in the 2008 Beijing Olympic, 2006 Commonwealth Games and 2004, 5 and 7 World Championships. So you're starting to get the impression this bloke might know what he's talking about. He was a senior sports psychologist for the New South Wales Institute of Sport. Lots of experience, hands-on experience, 15 years of it, in fact. Paul, welcome to the Near Post Local.
Thanks for having me.
Why Paul Penner? I sat in on one of Paul's discussions with a group of emerging and elite swimmers at an ACT swimming club. He spoke to the swimmers in one group, and at a later time, he spoke to the parents. Now, I thought this was very clever. And out of that came a curious little metaphor for life that's been picked up in our family. It's called swim in your lane, but we'll talk about that a bit later. I was most impressed with the way Paul pitched at the two groups. Paul, you must have been at this a fair while, mate.
I'd like to say that I used it as an athlete, but unfortunately I didn't. I think I learned a lot of the things looking back at my own sporting career as well as you know, studying human behaviour and psychology through university for a fair while, and I love what I do and just learn a lot from watching human behaviour and certainly specialising in what it takes to perform and watching successful athletes and seeing what they do in order to be successful.
Yeah, it's a wild ride for an elite athlete, isn't it?
It's so complex. Often I don't think professional athletes, whether they be, I want to say professional athletes. You don't have to be paid to be professional, but although it makes it a little bit easier, full-time athletes, you know, unfortunately get a rap for having a glorious lifestyle, but it certainly doesn't portray what is actually required to be somebody who's incredibly proficient at what they do.
Just before we go any further, it might help the listener out there to know the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist.
It's one that gets asked all the time.
Yeah.
Psychologist is somebody who's principally studied about assisting people change their behaviours through adjusting their thought patterns or being able to control it, or given strategies to be able to control their feelings, and then certainly empowering them to be able to shape their behaviours. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who specialises in working with the brain, and their approach commonly uses pharmacotherapy, drugs, as well as or in conjunction to strategies that look at the way people think. So there's a big contrast between the two. Sometimes we work in close collaboration together.
Yep.
Sometimes we work very independently from each other. So it comes down to the individual case.
Well, let's drill down into the job of the sports psychologist, because I can see the listener out there in the home or on the podcast thinking, well, what's that got to do with my child that plays football? Mm. Might have a lot to do, actually.
Yeah, it actually does. Often I get asked, who can use sports psychology and why is sports psychology important? And is my son or daughter too old, too young, or when should they be using it? No, I look at the range of people that I work with, and the youngest athlete that I've worked with is 6, and the oldest is 78. And a lot of what I do is, and I talk about it this way, it's about assisting people improve.
Yep.
Now, generally I think that we all can improve. I know I'm a significantly better psychologist than I was, 5 years ago, because of the experience that I've had, the way that I manage myself, the way that I provide, say, better questions to go after athletes. Just having that experience makes me a better psychologist. So I think that we can all continuously improve. A sports psychologist is necessarily there about helping athletes take those steps.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily for somebody who's got a problem. It's about, I like to say it's a proactive thing of making sure that individuals that are building the blocks that's going to help them be successful in the future.
Indeed, and that can happen at any level of sport, can't it?
Oh, 100%. A couple of weeks ago I was out talking about swimming. I seem to get a lot of exposure to swimming because of my background, although I work with a wide range of sports. But I was presenting, similar themes to 6- and 8-year-olds, and then a couple of days later I was backing it up and I was talking to some of the guys that I went to the Olympics with, and some of the themes are pretty similar. It doesn't really matter your age you are. Some of the keys to performing are exactly the same message, whether you're a junior athlete just kicking it off in your sport or whether you're an elite performer preparing for the Olympic Games.
Indeed, and I know in the football club I'm associated with, we had a senior level team that comprised of some terrific young players, couldn't win a game, and they felt it.
Oh, totally, I suppose that's where, what does a sports psychologist do? The diversity of my role goes across a broad area. It's not just catering for individuals and helping individuals perform. It's about working with coaches so that they can become better coaches. It's working with support staff so they work coherently as a team. It's about working with the athletes and the coaches so they all work coherently as a team. So there's many levels and layers to sports psychology, and I suppose that's one of the things that I find most fascinating. It's not just about getting one individual to perform. It's also getting that individual and their coach or their manager to perform, but also then helping the team go out there and produce a good result as well.
And I think that neatly sums it up, because the need to improve hits at every level and everyone involved in the activity.
Yeah, totally. In some sense, we all need it. We all need... It's like a top-down, bottom-up sort of approach.
Mm. But if we drill down into the specific athlete, now, what does the specific athlete need a sports psychologist for?
And I suppose that's a part of the stigma of psychology.
Mm.
Many people believe that you only need a psychologist when you're stuffed in the head.
yeah, that's what they think.
Exactly, and that's not just a just not people's approach just for sport. It's a general one for society, you know.
Mm.
You know, the stigma attached with seeing a psychologist, while I think it's an unfair label, generally means that you're screwed.
Mm.
Or you've got something wrong with you. In actual fact, a lot of us could benefit from, you know, using the resources of a psychologist so that enables us to perform. And I suppose that's one of the big differences between what I do as a primary part of my business is it's about performance enhancement. Just talking in general terms, an individual needs a level of skill, both physical and mental, to be able to go out there and perform.
Yep.
The closer they get to the pinnacle, to their peak performance,
yep.
Or their, you know, we look at it in football and we go, you know, playing in Europe or, you know, playing in the A-League and certainly going to the World Cup, the more pressure an individual is under increases the different type of skills that they are required to then perform mentally, far beyond the, you know, goal setting, self-talk, visualization, activation, relaxation, concentration, the basic mental skills that we teach people, you know.
Mm.
When you're going out there and you're representing your country, you feel like the whole world's watching you. You've got to be pretty confident in your abilities, not only to execute the task, but also have that, it's a term that gets thrown around a lot, but that mental toughness,
mm.
that resiliency to be able to deal with what happens, because everybody knows who, you know, Lucas Neal is.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, it's not just restricted to football nowadays, you know,
mm.
show people the face of, you know, Harry Kewell, they're probably going to recognise him, and they may not have any interest in football.
Mm.
But they're going to recognise him, and having that to deal with that type of pressure is something that not everybody is born with, and mm. we actually have to help athletes be able to perform with that.
Yes, it's tricky, isn't it? When I go back to that phrase you used in the address I sat in on, swim in your lane. What a wonderful little phrase that's turned out to be, because as I understood what you were saying to the swimmers and later to the parents was, in the context of swimming, was deal with the things that you can make a difference on, you can control. Let the externalities, the other things you don't have any control of, pass you by.
Well, often we get our...
Is that a fair...
Oh, 100%. Often we get caught up, and this is not just specific to sport.
Mm.
It's a generalised thing. You know, often we get caught up on things that we can't control.
Mm.
And when you actually break it down and look at it, there's not actually a hell of a lot we do control.
Yeah, that's true.
Ask anybody who's, you know, had a case of, you know, swine flu or, or you know, have suffered a serious injury or illness, whether they actually wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
No, they didn't. You know, people often, you know, think that they can actually control winning.
Oh, no chance.
They actually can't. You know, if I could control winning, I actually wouldn't be a sports psychologist. I'd be, you know, the most successful golfer in history.
Yes.
But I'm a useless golfer, unfortunately. Often we get caught up on focusing too much on the things that we don't control, and that actually impacts us in a couple of different ways.
Mm.
When we focus on something that we don't control, we commit to something that's unrealistic.
Yes.
And then when, inevitably, I'm unsuccessful at chasing something that's unrealistic,
mm.
I become incredibly disappointed and disheartened.
Yeah.
And not only does it affect my task confidence, my ability to go out there and execute a task, it actually starts impacting on the way I see myself, my self-image, my self-esteem.
Yep.
So not only is it destructive from that point of view, but in terms of a performance point of view, you actually waste a hell of a lot of energy worrying about things that you actually can't control.
The worrying thing, as I look at some footballers, and it occurred to me this season when we were going through a rough patch, that... two people were being decisively affected, the players and the coach, wrestling with the same problem, and as often as not, getting distracted by the things they had no ability to influence in the next game anyway.
It's probably been one of my mantras, or been a big part of my mantra, having come back and had that experience of being part of the swim team at the Olympics, or being mm. part of the Australian Olympic team.
Yes.
I take it you were a normal person. You actually yeah. sat down and watched the Olympic Games on the couch.
Yep.
Drinking a can of Coke.
Yep.
Eating a couple of Dim Dams.
Yep.
See, normal people don't go to the Olympics.
Ah, that's right.
You know, normal people, you know, physically, a lot of people could achieve a hell of a lot more than what they're currently achieving. But mentally, normal people don't like pressure.
Yeah, that's
normal
right.
Normal people don't have the dedication, normal people don't have the commitment to then be able to go out and then perform.
Mm.
I see the results from the between Man U and Man City.
Yep.
And I look at it and go, you know, performing under that pressure.
Yes.
So early on in the season, such a big derby.
It's oppressive, isn't it?
Two crosstown rivals. And for them to score 7 goals.
Oh, unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. And normal people don't, you know, normal people don't have that capacity to perform.
No, no, indeed. And the players, in a sense, were risking everything.
And that's one of the big things. You know, you talk about risk, and it's one of the biggest things that I learnt from, or so many things I learnt from the Olympics, but the individual risk a person takes and is prepared to take when they pull on that green and gold and stand up behind a swimming block at the Olympic Games,
yes,
is absolutely phenomenal.
Now, can I just get you to pause there, because in your address to the swimmers, you entered, particularly with the parents, you entered that subject probably to the surprise of quite a few. It's the first time I'd actually thought of an elite swimmer being a risk taker. But you made the point that at the elite level, whether it's a footballer or a swimmer or something, these people are genuine risk takers, are they not?
Well, you have to be. You know, a person who doesn't want to take a risk doesn't set a goal of going to, you know, the World Cup. A person who's not, you know, comfortable with taking a risk doesn't stand up behind the swimming blocks in front of the whole nation televised, you know, and you can retrieve that data from YouTube anytime you like.
Yeah.
You're taking a massive risk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually concerned for our sporting future as a nation because...
Oh, yes.
You know, there's a massive trend against risk-taking. If you look at history, you know, and it's not just confined to our sporting history, Australians have been incredibly successful on an international stage because of that almost a reckless abandonment.
Mm.
Hang on, he's the world heavyweight champion. I'll jump in the ring with him. I've got nothing to lose.
Yep.
All of a sudden, I'm going to say kids, you know, they're growing up too fast, but kids have got a hell of a lot to lose.
Yeah, they do.
Now, there's a personal and often a family and certainly a societal expectation that they have to be getting the marks from school and they have to be, you know, proficient in all these different areas and they have to be successful, that, you know, 16 in sport, otherwise they're wasting their time.
Yeah, and that's the pressure in football all through the grades from junior through to senior.
When I'm getting to know an individual, and certainly coming from football, I ask, you know, what one of the first questions is, so are you making reps and what rep teams are you in? And it's just like, while I like the fact that there's outliers, we need outliers in sport. Individuals who make it successful from an untraditional or a not a normal pathway. Because it's actually good for the sport. You know,
yeah.
I come back to talk about swimming and I think it's incredibly good for the sport that someone like Matt Abood, who's, you know, big unit of a kid, he can make his first Australian swim team at 22.
Wow.
Because that's good for the sport because it gives every 19-year-old who's dedicated and committed and has got a bit of talent that they can actually do something with that talent. You don't have to be a 16-year-old and making the Australian swim team.
Yeah.
There's different ways to make it.
Yes, and in the football terms, the example would be the young Coffey Danning who's playing for Sydney FC.
100%.
Never spent a day in the Capital Football Academy or any other academy or the AIS or anything else for that matter. But there he is.
And comes off the bench and it'd be nice if he scored a couple more goals for us. But, you know, it's one of those things is that being able to go out there and actually take a risk, you know, pretty confronting. You know, I still remember it, that feeling that you got when you were a kid and you had to stand up and do public speaking in class.
Oh, yeah, it was awful.
And, you know, most people, one of their greatest fear is actually speaking in public.
Yeah.
And, okay, so speaking in public's at one level and it's, you know, more people fear speaking in public than shark attacks.
Yeah.
But how would people go then performing in public? You know, that type of pressure is magnified 1,000 times.
And if we just explore this sense of risk a little bit further, and I don't want the listener to, and the parent to get the idea that we're talking about risk in a dangerous sense. in the coaching world in football, there's a lot of doctrine now and a national curriculum, and look, we're going to improve them, and you know, we want them at young ages to express themselves and so on and so forth, and develop, and we won't hold tables, so they won't know who, you know, who won and lost. Well, kids always know who won and lost, but the moment they get into some serious coaching, all the flair gets knocked out of them, and if they try things on, the fear is that they're going to be marked down as someone who actually technically couldn't do something they needed to do.
See, and this is where, it's not that I challenge coaches, but...
Oh, it's all right, on the near post we challenge everyone, mate.
That's okay. I believe that you can't just make somebody technically proficient, tactically proficient, and physically fast, strong, and fit, and say that's enough.
No, it's not.
Yeah, you actually need somebody who can be confident, who can be assertive, who can be control that aggression, but also has the ability to go, well, hang on, you know, whether there's a, I'm going to, you know, take an NRL sort of slant for a second, instead of, you know, kicking it on the fist, I'm going to run it on the fist.
Yep.
There's a whole heap of analogies where it comes back to an individual's decision-making, especially when they're under pressure.
Yes.
And their ability to make good decisions and think creatively, you know, rarely does it come the way that an individual thinks it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, rarely does a coach ever script exactly what's going to happen and it actually turn out identically like that in the game.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Now, it's more often than not, an individual's ability to adapt, understand what's going on, and be able to be creative. Now, if we stifle that creativity and we don't allow athletes to be able to be creative, certainly we're limiting our ability to be successful and dynamic.
Well, indeed, and in our Premier League here, I watched a Premier League 16 game that illustrated that point earlier in the season. A coach I have particular respect for, a wonderful rapport with the young players who are largely 15, turning 16. He had a young player who was clearly frustrated with his performance. It was a very tight game and he interchanged him. And the player came off and he looked at him and said, "I'm not angry with you." He said, "I'm worried that you're upset." And the kid looked at him and he said, "Stop worrying. There's another team out there, mate. They've got a right to play too." Well, I thought that was sensational advice. The kid dusted himself off and 15 minutes he was back on and things were going a lot better for him.
And that's where little things make big differences.
Don't they just?
We look at it in sport, you know, and I have to come back and use some swimming examples.
Yeah, no, that's good.
70% of the world of the gold medals won at the World Championships in 2005 were won by a margin of less than 1%.
Oh, gee.
Now, I haven't done the maths on Beijing and the differences between the, you know, the time differences between first and second into the overall length of time swum. But, like, Michael Phelps won one of his gold medals by 1/100th of a second. I've been, as hard as I've been trying, on my stopwatch to get, you know, two clicks as close as I can together.
Amazing.
And the closest is 9/100th of a second. And a 100 metres butterfly, he won by 1/100th of a second.
Oh, yes.
Same event. Australian Andrew Lauterseen got a bronze defeating Ian Crocker, who was the current world record holder, by 1/100th of a second.
There you go.
The difference between good and great is quite small.
Yes.
The difference between great and phenomenal, while there's a lot of the attributes that we would distinguish between the individuals and look at what they're doing and how they're doing it. In elite sport, the margin is quite small, there is a natural attrition.
Yep.
I think there's a lot of individuals that are actually cheating themselves by not working hard enough.
And look, you mentioned something a while ago in this talk you gave. You talked specifically about the swimmers that were training at the AIS or at the very elite level. Then someone has to make a decision on the small number of our swimmers who will go to the Olympics, and the difference was extraordinary. There seemed to be a lot of people who had done a lot of work and they just hadn't nailed it.
and that's in the same in every institute of sport.
Yep.
You even look at the at junior soccer academies.
Yep.
You know, look at the kids that are in junior soccer academies around Australia and go, well, how many of those are actually going to make it to the a World Cup with the Australian team, or who's going to make it to European football?
Easier to pass through the eye of a needle, eh?
Oh, totally. One of the things is that often athletes will use sports psychologists at the back end of their career.
Yep.
You know, sometimes the athletes will give us an opportunity to work with them at the start of their career. As they're getting better, some athletes will use us for their entire career. Some athletes will use us as their career is starting to fade.
Yeah.
And, you know, giving up a career is incredibly difficult.
Very.
It's not only been a way of life, it's been a whole life experience. And to then tell somebody, hang on, I've got to stop being a sports psychologist,
mm-hmm.
when I've spent, you know, better part of 10 years at university, and it's been what I've been doing now for the last too long,
yeah.
that I can no longer do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Not only does my day-to-day life change significantly, but also the way that I feel about myself.
Yes, and yeah, absolutely right. And that, of course, the point you're making is it's the same in any walk of life where you make that massive personal commitment. Look, I wanted to talk to you also about parents. Mm. And if we can just visualise the young football player and or swimmer, whatever, moving through from, you know, from the junior end, they're into the high performance programs, they're starting to get selected in representative teams and so on. The role of the parent in the development of the elite athlete, could you just speak to that a little?
Well, I have to come out and say, I think the parents have got their hardest job.
Yeah.
I remember what I put my parents through as an athlete. It was incredibly difficult because whatever they do, they're going to be judged by.
Yep.
They're going to be judged by their sons and daughters. They're going to be judged by other people. And so it's an incredibly challenging job.
Mm.
One of the things that I look at is that parents have got it. The most important thing that a parent do is show unconditional love.
Yep.
Now, it's something that, children and... I keep on talking about the word children, but it's almost everybody. They can sense a level of an attachment.
Mm.
Now, I always tell in my parent presentations is, you know, three things that sense fear. Dogs, bees, and children.
Good one, yeah.
So that a child can be incredibly perceptive about whether you're approving or there's a level of disapproval with their performance.
Yes.
Now, it may be totally inaccurate, but that's that child's perception. I was working with a young gymnast, and she said, oh, I can tell when mum's happy with me. She takes me to Macca's after a competition. You know, so the kids learnt to associate the fact that, okay, when I do well, mum takes me to Macca's. When I do badly, we go straight home.
Mm.
So therefore, mum must be upset with me. You know, kids are incredibly perceptive about things. It doesn't mean they're always right, but their perception's right. That's what they feel.
And that's what you got to deal with.
And that's what one of the things you got to deal with. You know, you've got to be able to, and this is why I say it's incredibly difficult, you've got to be able to be the head coach, be, you know, the head physiotherapist, be the head psychologist,
yeah.
be the head dietitian,
yeah.
be the head doctor, and then not have an opinion or unless you're asked, and not show any emotion on basis on the way your son or daughter performs. It's incredibly difficult.
Yes, Paul, I got a bit of advice as a football coach from an old coach who was now in the business of instructing people to be coaches. And on the subject of particularly the junior football, he sort of scratched his head and looked at the group and said, in response to the question, you know, what can do the most harm to a junior footballer? And he just looked and he said, the drive home.
Oh.
And if you had one bit of advice for parents who have a young and talented player and desire to support their endeavours, what would it be?
Show unconditional love and give all you can.
Oh, mate, We can't do better than that.
No, exactly. It's that simple, but it's damn complicated.
Oh, is it ever. Paul, you've been incredibly generous with your time, mate.
No worries.
Thank you very much, and we must speak again.
Thanks, mate. Have a good weekend.
Well, that's it for the Near Post Local. Enjoy your football and futsal. See you next week. Get to the FFA State Institute Challenge this week at the AIS, and if the only game you get to see is one game, make it the game on Saturday at 2 p.m. at the AIS, where the challenge winner plays the All-Stars. See you next week. Ta-da. Every day.